WBTV's Good Question is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Jimini Boyd is a native Charlottean, a father, a felon, and the leader of a local organization that helps people who were formerly incarcerated. He's speaking to us about the decades he spent behind bars, the moment he realized he was going to be released, and his work to improve the community. We're asking him all about the twists and turns in his life.
I want to give the people who they deem that couldn't get it right, I want to empower them by giving them jobs.
This is WBTV's Good Question. We are joined by Jimini Boyd. He is the co-founder and executive director of Project Bolt. It's a special edition of WBTV's Good Question. Alex Giles here along with Jamie Bolt and Jack Vandertal from WBTV. Jimini, we wanted to ask you about your organization, your life, and some of the work you've been doing recently here in the Charlotte community. I wanted to see if you could start by just telling us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up.
Well, you know, my name is Jimini Boyd. Yes, it is the zodiac sign, born June 17th. I was born right here in Charlotte, North Carolina, on the west side of town. Actually, I've lived all over Charlotte because me and my mother were, you know, she was moving around a lot. Like, she was in situations where, you know, it caused problems in the household. Mm. I grew up in a dysfunctional household. I grew up around alcoholics, drug users, and things of that nature. And went to Sharon Elementary School, Wesley Hills Elementary School. I went to a multitude of schools here in Mecklenburg County. And the key to that, what I tell everyone is that, you know, I was incarcerated, you know, along this journey twice. The first time I was incarcerated, I was 16 years old, and it was it involved the shooting that happened at Myers Park High School football game back in 1990. And a young man lost his life, and another guy was shot. And I went to prison for it for 3 years. I came home with all the great ideas about what I wanted to do. But during that time, we were still living in a time where, you know, formerly incarcerated individuals really didn't have a say in anything. Mm. You know what I'm saying? If you had a record, that's what you had. Deal with it. You know what I'm saying? Society deemed us to be people that couldn't come home and better themselves. And I came home with the tools strapped around my waist. I came home with a GED because I dropped out of school in the eighth grade. People don't know that. And I don't mind telling people that because I think that's what makes me intriguing, that I could tell you I dropped out of school in the eighth grade and there is nothing I deem that I can't do. And I ended up getting a GED while I was incarcerated. I actually had small engineer repair certification, welding certifications, construction certifications. And I actually wanted to come home and do some welding. I wanted to build fences because I knew that would be a hot commodity moving forward because I then, I came home at 19, seen that the evolution was about to occur in our city. And I was like, man, it'd be pretty cool if I could just build fences and, you know, mm-hmm. you know, for people that they're going to need them and I could make money off of it. But at the time, I couldn't find a job to really assist me with that because the first thing that they would say, oh, that's the guy from the shooting where a young man was killed and he has this on his record. And, you know, it pushed me back to the streets. You know, I didn't want to go where I ended up at, but I didn't have a choice. I had a child on the way in 1994. My daughter was born, and I couldn't find a job. Nowhere would hire me. Like,
was that the checking of the box thing?
Exactly.
You know, you're a felon, and now we're just going to move on to the next applicant.
Exactly. And they'll do all the things to make you think that this is about to occur for you. But it didn't never happen. You know what I'm saying? So, like I said, I was pushed back to the streets, man, that eventually I ended up with 30 years for drugs and 20 years for guns in federal prison. There was no evidence. There was no guns, no drugs, no wiretap, no surveillance, no anything. Now, did I sell drugs? I ain't ashamed to tell people. Yeah, I sold drugs. I sold drugs because I had to, not because I wanted to. You know what I'm saying? people in society hold people at fault for things like that, but they never ask the question like, well, what could I have done to help this person? Mm-hmm. But they want to point the finger at you, right?
You're saying you didn't enjoy drugs. You didn't enjoy selling drugs to people.
Because I knew what it would cost me at the end of the day. So,
but options are limited.
Exactly. No jobs, no opportunity, child on the way, nowhere to stay. You know what I'm saying? So you tell me, what do I do?
Mm-hmm. People were depending on you.
Exactly. So do you sit there and say, oh, well, you have all these opportunities living in America. You have the American dream. I wish that's a cliche, and I wish people would stop saying that. Because when you are marginalized and you're black and brown in this country, things weren't just a cookie cutter for you and things just happened. Historically, things happened in order to place individuals in the positions that they are, right? Somebody had to be the downfall to say that we need prison population booming, right? Somebody had to be the downfall to say that we need drug use in the communities. Somebody has to be the downfall to we say that we need poor education, lack of resources in the communities. What this does is when we say that we need those things, it creates other avenues for other people to get money off of. And that's what it all trails back to. Mm-hmm. Like, how can we obtain money and resources off of these individuals who are marginalized? See, it's a plan by design that was stated. And I always go back to the one word that the government created. And my community, meaning the marginalized and black and brown community, wear this with a shield like it's something to be proud of. And that one word is project, right? People always say that, oh yeah, I'm from the projects, right? Without understanding what that word means. You were an experiment. Mm-hmm. That's why that word was created. Project means an experiment. We're gonna try something on you. Right? So society created these projects and these pockets, right, in our country, and the majority of the people were who that lived there? Black and brown people. Mm-hmm. Let's experiment. Let's boom the drug use. Let's boom the prison population. Let's take away education. Let's take away housing. Because down the line, what we're going to do is we're going to come back in and regentrify these areas because we're going to prove a point that these peoples, and I quote some of the individuals who were at this time, we were predators, if everyone remembers that, you know what I'm saying? And if you're old like I am, you know what I'm saying, which I'll be 48 in a couple months, you can think back to the commercials that were being shown in the late 80s where you see individuals, their mouth all white, they look demonic and all these things, and then they come back with something that says this is your brain on drugs. So it made us out of predators and monsters.
It wasn't even just predators, it was super predators.
Super predators.
Remember that?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I remember those. It was the Clinton administration and all that was going on and all those things. Can I take you back for a second?
Of course.
You said you got through the eighth grade, but you described how you bounced around from school to school. We know stability, obviously, in a child's life is everything, right? You stop and think back to that time when I was moving from place to place and not having stability in your life and how that affected you.
Yeah, I think about it all the time because I always tell myself, imagine if I was in a structured household, right, where my parents knew about education, their parents knew about education, how it would reflect it upon my life. Well, they don't tell them what I could have, who I could have been. Not to say that the journey that I'm on isn't right now isn't fascinating, right? But at the end of the day, there's no I don't put no limits on what I could have been had I been placed in the right situation.
That second stint where you were incarcerated, you ended up in for 20 years?
Yes, I actually did 20 years in federal prison. I was at maybe 10 different institutions throughout the United States over the course of 20 years, and I was 22 years old when I went in, and I was 42 when I came home, and it was a hell of an experience. Like, at times, I can still see myself in there, and at times, I get emotional. Every time I talk about it, I get emotional. because I get emotional because I know the lives that are in there that shouldn't be there, right? And they're being wasted away. And society doesn't look back or doesn't say that we actually fumbled the ball. We actually made a mistake. And lives are just sitting in there rotting away, man. That some fascinating guys that are incarcerated, bro. I mean, like, literally, you have no idea. Like, the knowledge that's sitting in prison walls right now. It'll blow your mind. If you just do a walkthrough and just have these conversations with women and men, you know, that are incarcerated, it'll take your breath away. And I think about that all the time, and I get emotional because I'm out here because the Creator planned for me to be here, right? But what about the brothers and sisters that are 2.4 million that are incarcerated? Like, what do we do? Like, do we just continue to have conversations? Like, are we going to really take a deep dive and say that, man, this had to be heartening on the individuals that are in there and the families that it affected? Like, we're talking about generations, right? We couldn't even get past slavery in the mindset of slavery. Now you tack on mass incarceration with that. Like, what do you see the future of marginalized citizens in our country?
What was the impact on your child?
Man, it was rough because our relationship is still hard to this day, right? And there are things that my child just probably want to ask but don't know how to ask, you know, and there are things that I want to say at times and don't know how to say it. And at the end of the day, I believe that the federal government should allow individuals coming home from incarceration to have a paid-for therapist. I think that would be key to recidivism, how we can cut recidivism. Because these individuals never had an opportunity. The therapists that they did talk to were incarcerated, and I wasn't talking about actually getting paid. I mean therapists that looked like them, wore the same uniforms that they did. Like, those are the therapists for the ones who have knowledge of self and understand that this isn't the end of the road, no matter how much time I have. You have a lot of guys and women that come in with 2 or 3 years and they think it's the end of the world. They have no self-motivation for themselves. So they reach out and hold these conversations with individuals that may have motivation and they may not never go home. But they always seem intriguing because people want to know, like, damn, how can you do this knowing that you don't have a date or knowing that your date is 2050? You know what I'm saying? So that becomes intriguing in why you're incarcerated. And I believe that's why I'm in the position that I'm in, because I was one of those individuals, even at a young age.
What kept you going as a young man and a good stretch of your youth was going to be spent behind walls?
Well, all of my youth, actually.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about it, I've spent 23 years of my 48 years incarcerated. And before 23 years of my 48. And when you think about it, I was 16 when I first went in, came home at 19, went back at 22. So technically, I only had 1 year as a man on the streets up until this point. So what kept me going was the fact that I always tell people this, and this, I even just told a guy this yesterday. It was a young man that reached out to me yesterday who read my article in the paper. Right. Never heard of him before in my life. And he told me I inspired him. He called me to tell me about his nonprofit that he wants to start. And I, you know, we was having a conversation and I told him, he was like, well, man, how did you make it through? And I told him, I say, the only thing that bothered me was the weekend, Saturdays and Sundays. I hated it because those were 2 days I knew I had to be incarcerated. Monday through Friday, I lived with the idea of saying the court systems are open, the federal government is at work, so anything is liable to happen with my case and I can go home today. So every day for 20 years, I told people I was going home today. It's just that up until mail call after 5 o'clock, I knew I would be there. Some people, I thought you was going home today. It just didn't work that day, today, maybe tomorrow. But I didn't claim what I had because I knew it was an unjust sentence. The idea of me being incarcerated for that long was unjustified. The actual whole scheme of things, of how they did it, you know, all that was unjustified. It was illegal. And I'm going to stand on that to the day I die. I know it was illegal because I've read and researched and even talked to some of the guys who told on me, who actually stated from their mouths that they only told on me because they were afraid to get more time. And the federal government knew that they were lying.
Mm. Help a listener understand that, because you said earlier, right, did I sell some drugs sometime? Yeah, I did. You're saying it was just the penalties that you were given were just to the extreme for what you actually did.
I had more time than Gene got it. John got his brother. I had more time than some drug lords that were in prison. And like I say, I sold drugs, but do you feel as though, I'm asking you this question, that small drug dealer on the street should have had 50 years in federal prison? Where there was no violence, no one got killed, no one got harmed or anything. And the number one consumer of any drugs are white males in America. Mm-hmm. But there are black males that are incarcerated more than anybody. So the two just, you know what I'm saying, when you look at how this thing is weighed out, there is an intent behind what was happening.
Was this the crack thing, the crack versus powder?
Exactly.
Cocaine, because obviously the sentencing was so much different. White people were taking the white powder cocaine, not getting nearly the sentences that those crack, basically the same drug, were getting.
You could take one little packet of sugar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it equated to 100 times the amount. You feel me?
Yeah.
So, and you can't tell me that isn't or wasn't by design.
At what point during your incarceration, that second round, did you realize that you had a shot to get out? When did you start to realize that I might be getting out of here?
I just told you, every day.
But at what point did it actually...
Every day. I can never change that.
Right.
It was from the time that I walked in there, because I believed in my heart that I hadn't done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Did I sell drugs? I'll tell you again. I'll tell you 1,000 times. Yes. But what I'm attacking is the fact that did I sell drugs to the amount that it equated to that I should have received all this time? And I'm going to tell you no.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
When did word come down? When did they notify you you're getting out?
Well, word came down because, thank God for President Obama, it came in and changed some things that were happening in the justice system that needed to happen. He didn't get what he wanted, but he reduced it from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1, right? So it gave me an opportunity to be able to get my sentence reduced. And that was in 2000. Damn, when was it? I received the letter in 2015, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
I received notice in 2015, August, I believe it was. August 2015.
Do you recall the day you went home?
Oh, man, I recall the day I got the letter before I even went home. And it was, I cried literally hard. I never forget, I was getting ready to take a shower. I was actually taking a shower. And I had been waiting on my letter to hear whether I would be going or staying. And you got to realize, I was on an emotional roller coaster for 20 years with the justice system.
Mm-hmm.
One minute they say you can, next minute they say because of one word, which is retroactive. I think they need to just take that out of the dialogue for law, because it makes no sense that you can walk right into the same thing that I'm charged with, and you can be sentenced to a way lesser amount of time, and I can never get my time reduced. So the day that I actually got my letter, I was in the shower, and I was afraid, man. I walked around afraid every day because I was like, man, here you go again. This is that emotional roller coaster. Is it really time for me to go yet? You know what I'm saying? Like, I had just got an incident report. You know, I got caught with a cell phone. And I got caught with a cell phone because, man, they were all in the prison and I wanted to use it. And I wanted to be able to talk to my daughter, my mother. You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't want to do no anything with it. I just wanted to talk to my loved ones, right? So, but the cell phone, me getting caught with the cell phone could actually keep me incarcerated because they could shoot me down for my motion that I had in, because you had to have damn near perfect track record. You know what I'm saying? So I'm in the shower and the CEO comes up. He said, Gemini, you got some legal mail. Bro, when I tell you, my heart has never stopped before. It literally stopped. Literally. This ain't no bull job. Felt like my breath was just, because I knew what it was. I told myself, man, there go that letter. This is it right here, Gemini. I'm literally like a boxer or something. You know, getting myself, you know, prepared for whatever may happen.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, I jump out the shower and I go get dressed. I do all the things I need to do. I'm taking my time to get up there. And I tell the CEO, I said, yeah, I'm ready to go upstairs, man. You know, you can let me out. I can shoot upstairs right quick. You can call him, let him know I'm coming up. He did that. I go upstairs and there's the secretary is there. And she asks me, she said, Gemini, what mail were you expecting? I said, well, I've been waiting on my crack reduction letter for quite some time right now. You know, it's been a year or two, you know, that I've been battling back and forth. And she just calmly just takes the letter, because they have to open it. Even though it's legal mail, they have to open it in the presence of you, right? And she calmly opens the letter. And she said, you waiting on what you say? I said, yeah, my crack reduction letter. She calmly just looks at the letter, don't express anything. I'm telling her about.
You're just dying inside,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm like, she's just taking her time. She looks over. I've never seen nobody with a poker face like this before. And we talked about this afterwards.
Oh, my gosh.
And she calmly just reads the letter and just said, well, okay, here you go. And just hands me the letter, right?
Life-changing mail.
And the letter, bro, soon as I looked at it, it said, granted. I didn't have to read nothing else. I broke down.
Yeah.
Literally, tears just started running down my face. And here I am, you know, in federal prison, been in prison for 20 years, and I have this white female sitting in front of me, and I'm crying in front of her. Like, how that's going to look if word get back? You feel what I'm saying? That I'm in the joint, which I didn't care, you know what I'm saying? I make a joke about it all the time because she even told me, she said, Gemini, you deserve this. She said, it's okay for you to cry. And it made me cry even harder.
Yeah.
Because she, here this woman is, didn't even really know me or nothing at all. Right? We never had a conversation. And she was cheering for me and telling me that I was deserving of what I was receiving.
Wow.
So I was crying and I just tried to get myself together. And I went downstairs in my unit, bro, and I just screamed to the top of my lungs. Mm. Everybody was knowing that I've been waiting on this particular letter. I screamed to the top of my lungs and it just froze the unit and everybody just turned around. They knew what I had.
Yeah.
Cause I said, boy, I got it. And everybody in the unit just started cheering for me. And it was just one of those moments, bro.
How soon after when did you actually get out?
About 4 months later.
Okay.
It killed me for 4 months. I had to walk around.
Wow.
Knowing.
I thought it was like day of.
No, it's supposed to have been day of, but they had to do all this paperwork, get all this stuff together. And
golly.
It was 4 months in December when I came home. And I came home with a plan. I told my stepdad about me coming home, but I didn't tell my mother or my daughter. So he had to walk around with that. For 4 months.
Wow. Told that info. Wow. How do you do that? That's not
easy. Didn't tell anyone,
good
right?
Luck.
So when I actually came home, I went to my daughter's house first. She was in the room. It was her kid's father and his brother, right? So I was trying to ease there without notifying her. I couldn't call, I couldn't do anything. So I had to kind of knock on the door. And if she came, okay, here it is at the door. You feel me? But a young man slid the curtain open. And me and my daughter look so much alike, it'll blow your mind. We identical. We look just alike. It blows my mind sometimes. Because it's like I'm looking at my damn self. But he slid the curtain open, right? And his mouth fell open. And he goes, oh, that's Kai Daddy. I read his lips. And I did him like this. And I said, right? So he opens the door and he's still standing there like in shock. So I'm like, where is Kai? And he's like, she's in the room. So I go to her room and I knock on the door. And she was like, yeah, what's up? What's up? She was saying something. only thing I did was took the door handle and pushed the door open. And she's laying there in her bed, and she rolls over and looks, and she, everything froze for her. She just started going, oh, my God, oh, my God. And she's shaking real bad. Uh-oh. When she stands up, she just starts crying because she can't believe I'm standing in the doorway of her room. It had been 20 years. My daughter was 2 years old when I left. And I'm standing there, and she can't believe it.
You hadn't felt her touch in that long?
Man, I hadn't. Well, throughout visits.
Yeah.
But I hadn't held my baby as a free man in 20 years.
My goodness.
And she is just sitting there in my arms, and she's trembling, and she's crying. I'm crying again. I get emotional thinking about it now. You know what I'm saying? And I'm telling her, you know what I'm saying? I'm happy that I'm here for you. And I say, but we got it, because I got to go to the halfway house. So I'm like, well, we got to go see your grandmother, right? So get yourself together and let's shoot over there right quick. So she's having a hard time putting her, she was still pregnant. She said she's having a hard time putting her shoes on, clothes on. She just can't believe that I'm sitting in the living room at this point. And so we get to my mother's house. I call my stepdad. I'm like, yo, Kenny, I'm on my way to the house. He said, okay, well, I'm going to take your mother to the store or something, and we'll just come back. So it's a video of this, too. And my mother, I'm sitting in my mother's house, and Kenny calls and says, well, you know, we'll be there shortly. And I'm sitting in my mother's living room, so I stand up when I hear him pulling the driveway. And when my mother opens the door, bruh, if my stepdad had not been behind her,
oh, no.
She'd have fell. Because she literally fell backwards. When I'm standing in her doorway, she goes, oh, my God, what are you doing? My mother thought I escaped.
Oh, no.
Literally. Yeah. She's like, what are you doing here? How did, do you got to go back? What's going? She literally thought I escaped.
Oh, my goodness.
So when she opens the door, she goes, oh, my God, and falls backwards. And my stepdad is there to catch her. So when she walks in, she's crying and can't believe that I'm standing there. She's asking me, what did I do? I'm like, Ma, I'm not going anywhere. I'm here to stay. I said, I was released.
I'm out.
Exactly. And she was like, oh, my God, you don't have to go back. I said, only thing I got to do is just go to the halfway house, which is literally I could walk to my mother's house. From the halfway house to my mother's house. I can walk literally on Remount Road when it was there. And she's just crying. And the only thing that she could say is that, and you smell so good. And I was like, all things to say, that's all you could come up with. And she was like, she was just crying and couldn't believe it. I was there, bro. And she turns around. She's mad at my stepdad now. She's mad at everybody that knew about it and didn't tell her. Mm-hmm. And I told her, I said, Ma, I dreamed of this moment. Mm. I knew that one day this moment would happen for me. I knew that in preparation throughout all these years, I prepared for this particular moment. I wanted to be there to surprise you and my daughter. And it worked out literally. That's why I tell people, when you really want something, say it. Speak it into existence, and it shall happen. Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer of that.
How did you let all the frustration of those 20 years go to then become some sort of force for good and force for change?
I haven't let it go. I'm afraid that, you know, people ask me all the time, say, Gemini, why aren't you angry? Why aren't you upset? You should be mad. You should be this. And I always tell them, if I'm upset, I lose.
What does that mean?
That means that if I'm angry, everything that I've accomplished thus far, everything that I want to accomplish moving forward, I won't have, because then I start taking it out on the people who did me wrong. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that feels like to say that everything has been released. You know, my motivation is the strength to know that I'm doing exactly what I want to do to try to help other people. And that's how I kind of release it to a point to where that you probably could say that that's how it's being done, but I don't feel it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I haven't had that one particular moment to say that, damn, Gemini, you made it. To this day, and I've been home 6 years almost. Well, I have been home 6 years now.
Was it difficult going from 20 years incarcerated in federal prison to back in Charlotte?
That's another question that I'm asking. I always tell people no, because I prepare for this from the day that I walked in the door. I was preparing for my release. So I wasn't sitting around, you know, knowing that one day it was going to occur and then they kicked me out and I didn't have a plan, idea, or anything. I've been preparing this, for the day that I walked out from the day that I walked in. So, nothing has. If there wasn't even a culture shock, honestly. Because, like I said, I was using cell phones in prison. So, my job was to keep up with everything. I read everything. I love to read, and I know reading transformed the mindset, mm-hmm. right? And from transforming my mind, I changed my heart. And my heart becomes softer because I understand human beings now. I understand. I even forgive the people who actually put me in there, right? Mm-hmm. Because, and that's hard to do, that's hard to say. But I do. Like I can't hold on to that. If I hold on to it, now it's not that we're going to be sitting around having kumbaya moments. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But I can understand that I just need to stay away from you, but I still forgive you. Mm. You know, so that's just where I am with it, bro.
We're talking to Gemini Boyd, co-founder and executive director of Project Bolt. We've talked about his life behind bars. When we come back, we're going to ask about the organization he's running to help other people re-enter society after incarceration.
If you think or know you had COVID-19, you can be around others after 10 days since symptoms first appeared, and after 24 hours with no fever without fever-reducing medication, and after other symptoms have improved. If you have tested positive for COVID-19 and you had no symptoms, you can be around others 10 days after you got tested for COVID-19. To learn more, visit cdc.gov/coronavirus.
Where did Project Bolt come from? Where did that concept get developed?
I was actually laying in the bed with our co-founder is Jewel Hayden. And her and I were having ideas, bouncing ideas around. And it started with me and other guys that I was incarcerated with. Oren Jackson, Amir Shabazz, and Cecil Jackson, and others, a whole lot of other guys that I could name also throughout the country, not just in Charlotte. But we will always have these powwow conversations about, you know, how can we make a difference when we go home, right? Like, what are some of the things? So I started looking into the nonprofit field. I started looking at, Maxine Waters and Jesse Jackson and Reverend Al Sharpton. And I would just look at what they were doing with nonprofits. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Rainbow Coalition or something like that. One of them. And I was saying to myself, like, man, I could do this. Maybe this is a way that I could get back into society and give back. So I started, you know, thinking about all the things that we could do, and it started to become simple, you know. So Jewel and I started pitching some ideas around as well, and we needed to come up with a name, and I'm good with acronyms. I could come up with something at the drop of a dime. So I'm laying, and I'm trying to figure out how can I bring something together that could be, I wanted to mean something powerful, you feel what I'm saying? And I wanted to be something that brought people together. And Bolt kept just ringing in my head because I kept saying, I wanted to be like a strong bolt of lightning or something mm-hmm. like that. That when it hits your heart, it sends a shockwave through you, right? So Bolt was the word. I said, man, what can I do with Bolt then? And then I just started pitching words around from the dictionary. I just started thinking about words that started with the letter B. And it just started, man, it literally came, and I promise you, it didn't take 3 minutes after I thought about the word Bolt. It just mm-hmm. 3 minutes later, oh, Bill and I standing lives together. How'd that sound? I thought it sounded pretty cool. Mm-hmm. You know, because my favorite word in the acronym is together. Mm-hmm. We can't do nothing apart. We have to do everything together.
Mm. What's the mission then?
Well, the mission started, right, for the formerly incarcerated, because that's where I came from. Right, I wanted to make sure that I could come home and help individuals get acclimated back into society, helping them with license, you know, finding places to stay, finding resources, whether you needed clothes or anything, just all the check marks that you need, right, to transition back into society. Because people don't know, people such as myself face 47,000 obstacles every day I walk out my door. That's what I face. Because I have a felon, right? So I started saying, like, how can I combat some of these issues? Because I know what people are going to need. So we just started writing things down, right? Which became the mission. But in life, I tell people all the time, in life, you have to be, like, on an evolution type thing. You have to evolve in anything you do, right? So as we started working in communities, I started telling, you know, the team, like, look, man, the problem seems to be poverty. Poverty sits in the middle of a hub, like it is the centerpiece, and all these different spokes are all these different issues, meaning poor education, mass incarceration, violence, domestic violence, all these things that plague the marginalized communities. So I started saying, like, we have to attack poverty. Mm-hmm. But poverty isn't just me giving you something. Poverty is changing the mindset that you say to yourself every day that you're poor. If you say that every day that you're poor, guess what you're going to be? Mm-hmm. Poor. So you have to try to change the mindset, but you have to do that in a way to say that you have something in a resourceful way to give individuals, right? And that resourceful way looks like, for me, is that I try to find out what it is that individuals need and want for themselves, right? So we can get the need out the way, right? When, I'm gonna take that back. We get the want out the way early. And we start showing you the difference in needs and wants, right? So what is it that you need to make your life better? What particular job? What do you want to be? And all these different things. And we always get things that deal with vocational training or something like that in the Black community. So whether it be CDLs or anything like that. And I like to give a big shout out to NC Works for allowing, you know, me to be able to just, like, I literally can just pick up the phone and call Danielle Frazier or Anna London and be like, look, I got a guy right here that wants his CDLs without a drop of a dime. She or either one of us, just give them the number. Give them my number, like not a case manager's number or anything. I'm able to give these numbers to a COO and the CEO, and they immediately handles this from there. Because what I try to tell them is that I don't need something that says pick a number. Mm-hmm. When I give you someone, I need for their lives to start changing right then, mm-hmm. if we're going to make this thing work in the community, right? Because what's more fearful of anything is individuals are afraid to go down to these buildings and talk to these people. So, but if you have a direct contact, yeah. it makes it easy.
Is there a small window then, right, that to make that opportunity happen? Otherwise,
exactly.
it could go sideways.
It could go sideways. And then you do one thing to me, mm-hmm. and that is I lose the trust of the people. Mm-hmm. My objective is to always know that there has to be trust in the community. There has to be hope, and there has to be value. Those three things have to exist in our communities. That's what's been missing.
And you can have a job, and right now, you know, with worker shortages, et cetera, hopefully that's easier to come by. But then there's still that issue of finding a place to live in this city.
Exactly.
And you mentioned gentrification earlier, right? Neighborhoods have been destroyed and lost. And where can people live today in this city and afford it? That's the hardest part right now, isn't it?
I mean, It's so heartening that it's hard for me to talk about, because that's the one topic and the one subject that I haven't been able to, like, really direct people to. And it's like our city, bro. It's like a Picasso painting, right? Charlotte is a beautiful city, mm-hmm. right? Unless you live on the inside of it, then it's not beautiful. For the people who are actually living in this city that are marginalized, this city isn't beautiful to them. They don't even know the beauty of this city because they can't even get the idea of going to take advantage of greenways and just seeing the city that it has become over the years, right? Because they're dealing with starvation, lack of jobs, lack of housing, the school department or they are even marginalized. Hell, you go over there and look at Miles Park, it looked like a damn college compared to West Charlotte and Hardin High School, West Mac, right? It looks terrible. The books are terrible, right? But yet and still, we got, what, almost $1 billion a few years ago for the school funding and all this? And I'm still trying to see whether that money goes to the schools that I frequent, kids that I know about. But we want to try to say that it needs to, they need to make changes within themselves. It's going to take resources, bro. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, I'm tired of our city playing with these people that live in this city with these facade type issues that they keep bringing up. But it's going to really take some what I call no more status quo, right? Because the status quo, we've reached the pinnacle, the top of the status quo, and it has failed us drastically.
Kind of leads into the last topic I had for you before we let you go here. I know we've kept this going a little while now. You're currently putting together some candidate forums for local political races. What gave you that idea?
What gave me the idea was that I commend the BPC, I commend the NAACPs, I commend all these big systems, right, that hold these topics, hold these debates, town halls, and things like that. But what brought it for me was that what are we doing on the lower level for the people who can make a difference in these nominations, these votes, right? And we weren't doing anything, right? They're holding these conversations and things like that without really inviting the people that it affects, mm-hmm. right? You have all these big systems that come in from Ballantyne, Miles Park, all these, and these are the places that the candidates feel as though they must run to. Oh, I gotta go over there. I gotta get this money, or I gotta get this sponsorship from such and such, such and such, without saying to themselves, well, damn, what about the people who are over here starving? What about the people who don't have a job, right? What they do is take that conversation that they wanna have over here, they take it to these big entities and say, well, this is what we want to do over here, right? Without even implementing the people, without even having the people at the table that can make a difference for themselves. And I was just tired. I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of seeing the same old people with the same old events and the same old people keep getting elected and things. I'm just tired of the whole everything without community really being based in what is happening. So I came up with an idea like, hey, man, let's just put something out there and let the community come up with the questions that need to be asked that affects them. Mm. They don't know nothing about no 2040 plan and all. People who are out in the streets starving, don't have nowhere to, they don't give a damn about nothing.
Yeah, zoning laws in South Bend.
Yeah, they don't care nothing about that. Right. You know what I'm saying? The new greenway that they trying to build and all that. How can you change their life right now is the question that they want to ask. Who are you is another question that they want to ask. Why are you running for this particular seat is another question that they want to ask. And how will you affect and help change the people that are most affected by these issues in our community? That's what they want to know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They don't want to know all that other stuff. You know what I'm saying? And this gives them an opportunity to empower them. I want to empower the people because people have to understand the people are the power, not the money. It's the people when it comes to elected officials. I don't care how much money you may have. You can have a $2 million operation, but guess what? If you need 2,000 votes, right, and you got a $2 million operation, but I got the 2,000 votes, who you think the stronger person is? Mm-hmm. Me.
How do we deal with, I mean, you know, we're talking about like education and housing, and job opportunities, and, you know, all these things that are sort of long range. They don't happen overnight.
No.
Meanwhile, you know, you've got a 14-year-old kid shooting another 14-year-old kid. You know what I mean? It's like, what do we do in the interim? What can we do now to make a difference?
Well, first of all, and I'm just going to give myself a plug right now. that is empower and invest deeply into Project Boats of the world, Team True Blues of the world, United Neighborhoods of Charlotte of the world, and all these different organizations that are out there for the struggle, Block Love. There's some amazing people out there doing amazing things, right?
You're talking the boots on the ground folks.
And they don't get no, and recognition isn't you giving me. I received the Martin Luther King Award, and I was very appreciative that it was, that people took notice in what I do in the communities, right? But the Martin Luther King Award doesn't provide housing for me personally, right? The Martin Luther King Award doesn't provide resources and money for me to build structurally, outwardly, from within with my organization, right? So it takes resources. It takes real money. And I'm not talking about, no, okay, we just gave you, we'll give you $20,000 or $40,000. I'm appreciative.
Sure.
Don't get me wrong, man, but I have to have people understand that that ain't no money. In 2022, man, a five-figure anything ain't no money. It is not any money. People have to get that out their mind that, you know what I'm saying, that this is some money. You have to be in the middle to upper end of six figures, moving towards seven figures, to make a difference in your community. I was told that I was invited to something that the city of Charlotte and some, and I think it's Leading Opportunities, are doing coming up soon. And they talked about $400 million that was spent in the last 5 years. You know the question I asked them?
Where?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, wait, man, you give me $400 million right now, there won't be a homeless person in Charlotte.
Yeah. So you aren't buying into the fancy check presentation from Bank Business X to Organization Y.
The reason being, I studied this
nonprofit
stuff when I was in prison. I understand how I can pick up the phone. Hey, Alex, don't you got that organization over there called WBTV where you and your nonprofit is working on? And you, yeah, you know, that's what we got. Oh, well, how about I'm going to shift $200,000 over there to you, you know what I'm saying, post, because you're my friend, right? So the money never leaves the circles. The money never leaves the people who are in power. Like, I always told everybody, I want to meet Hugh McCall and I want to meet Mike Marsicano. Yeah. That's who I want to meet. I want to talk to the people who make, who are power shifters in this city. I'm tired of talking to the people who don't really mean nothing.
But obviously you still see hope because you keep going.
Yeah. I never give up. Because if I give up, what that says to the community? The community has latched on to all these different organizations, right? And community is saying that, man, we thank you. We appreciate you. Without you, I don't know what's going on. I just told you I got a call from a guy that's been locked up 9 years for murder, right? Never met a young white male. Never met him before in my life, right? Calls me on the phone and congratulates me, tell me that I'm his hero. I don't even know the guy. But he say, man, you're doing everything that I want to do, man. You're making a difference even from within here. And I had to sit there and I had to take that in yesterday, right? I even take in the fact that I get calls from counselors and case managers from prison institutions saying that, well, we seen something about Project Boat. We have a client, we have a young male that's coming home. How can you help him? Like, I just had notice from the damn federal public defender's office who like an idea that I have that hopefully is about to happen, and that well, we'll be more effective with individuals that are even going in who have already been sentenced. Because there's a way that our city needs to know about what it takes from the moment that you get sentenced, what it's like for you. Like, I need to have these conversations with individuals so we can start now with the transition for the future. From having these conversations, for empowering me to be able to say, sit down with my team of individuals and like, this is what we got to do with Alex, right? Alex just received 10 years in prison and we have to go let Alex know what it takes for him to transition through to get to the low security institutions, to be able to get close to home and to be able to be prepared with a plan when Alex walks out the door opposed to just saying, okay, Alex, go do 10 years and we'll see you on 9 years in a couple months. And that's what's happening in our prison system, and we wonder why individuals are going back home, I mean, coming back to prison so fast.
I want to jump back just to Jamie's question real quick and have you clarify from a nonprofit perspective, when it comes to doing the work and getting stuff done and building something, what is the difference between, you know, here's $10,000, here's $20,000 for Project Bolt versus that upper six figures, seven figures? What would that mean, like, physically between what you were able to actually do on the street?
Man, I could really, 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 truly build our operation. That's what I'm looking for, operational money, not program money. Program money is operational money. Because if you don't have, I can start empowering people by giving them jobs. Hmm. That's my goal, man. I want to give the people who they deem that couldn't get it right, don't have this, don't have the mindset to do this and do that. I want to empower them by giving them jobs to go back and help the same people that they, the communities that they destroyed. There's no better story than a story that says that we're empowering the people who destroyed this particular community. Now these individuals are the ones who are so transformative that they've changed the complexity of the way people think in this community, because that's the key. You have to change the mind. I don't care what nobody say. You want to change what's happening in our communities? Help change the mind. You do that by providing resources and opportunities, because you create value. That's why I say there's trust, hope, and value, right? When you create value, individuals have something they want to hold on to. They don't want to tear it down. I create value within myself, which allows me to create value in you, you and you, because I see you now as a person, right? And you see me as a person. We've created value for one another. And once that value is created, we change communities, bro. We change communities. You don't want to, I don't want to harm you, Alex, because guess what? I know you. You're valuable to me. I am valuable to you. We're going to work together on how we're going to create something opposed to me saying, oh, man, there go Alex. He got on blue today, or he got on red today. He got on black today. Let me shoot him. Oh, there goes Alex, the one guy I was talking to on social media, and he had this and I didn't have it. So let me try to take it. That sounds like people are devaluing themselves. They don't know what they have in themselves to give themselves opportunities to make a difference.
You want to remind people that they matter.
Exactly. That's the key, bro. Because when you matter, I matter. Mm. That's just the way it is.
We're coming up on an hour here with Jim and I, Boyd. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Jack, Jamie, anything else you have
to say? I just want to know if people want to get involved, they want to help you out, they want to make, even if it's, you know, $100 yeah, donation. Yeah, yeah. Right now.
If you take $100 and you take 1,000 people, then we got some money.
How can they get you a website?
Website is www.projectbolt.org, and you can also reach us at info.project-bolt.com. Where you can reach us at, or you can also reach us at jboyd0818@gmail.com. Phone number is 980-395-8643. So
putting it all out there.
Yeah, that's who I am. Instagram, everything, Project Boat 2018. Yeah. Instagram, Facebook, Project Boat. Twitter, 2018.
Any lasting message you'd like to share, Gemini?
No, the only message that I like to leave is that, you know, it's been a struggle to really get to where I am. I've been homeless before. Since I've been home, I haven't had opportunity to really, because I have a record, to find somewhere to stay at times. And yet and still, I'm going to continue to do this work. But I try to be transparent as much as possible so people can see the adversity that I face, and I become real to them, the same people that I choose to help. And I just pray that our community and our society sees that individuals like myself can help you solve these issues and these problems. Don't overlook me to get to a bigger system that you deem fit to be able to do a particular job, because I'm the author of the book you're trying to write, that you are reading and that you're trying to take quotes from, right? Because without people like me, there is no justice system. If there was never a law broken, then there wouldn't be one to be fixed. You wouldn't have to go get a PhD in criminal justice, right? So why overlook the people that wrote the book?
Gemini Boyd, co-founder and executive director of Project Bolt. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
WBTV's Good Question is a product of WBTV in cooperation with Queen City Podcast Network and Balto Creative Media. From WBTV, Good Question is produced by Jack Vandertal. Special thanks to Jamie Bull. For the Queen City Podcast Network, WBTV's Good Question is produced by Brian Baltashevitz and Maria Delgado. Production coordinator, Taylor Robinson. It is recorded at the Queen City Podcast Network studios at Advent Coworking in Charlotte, North Carolina.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.